You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything. Oh my gosh.
We're your hosts, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And that was Hot Texas Swing Band with their original song, Hot Texas. And we have a full-on house tonight, Jim. We got friends waiting to join us. Let's welcome Henry Park and Bob Brill.
Ah! Hi, guys. How you doing?
Doing good. Excellent.
Like old home week. We're so happy to have our friends Henry Park, who is with us the first Thursday of every month. This is the first Thursday in June. And Mr. Bob Brill, a past co-host of the Writer's Block with me.
Thank you.
Many years. And it's like friends in the studio. Yeah.
I don't know if Henry reads all those books or not, but, you know, that's a big background.
Oh, he watches a lot of movies and shows. That he certainly does. So we were all together recently at Santa Clarita. Do you all have any comments about that Santa Clarita Cowboy Festival of a month ago?
I love that, and I'm so glad it was back after a three-year hiatus. And so next year I can have a book out, because I always debuted my Western novels each year at that event, and it was a couple of years, so, and so many other things going on, I didn't write another one. So the one we're going to talk about tonight is the most recent one, but no, I can't wait till next year.
All right. And Henry, what were your thoughts?
Oh, I was just delighted to be back. So many events, frankly, have disappeared over the past few years. It was great to be back and have it really full force. Santa Clarita is such a great place to visit, and it's always just so much fun. So
it was really fun. And and Jerry, Christina, if you're watching tonight or somewhere down the road, we missed you, and we missed your husband Jim, and we know that you were both with us in spirit. And Jerry, we just want to send out again a love to you for all of the years that you worked behind the scenes to line up all the guests and keep us running. And I know a little bit more about what that's like now.
Yeah.
So let's see, Henry, you want to say something? You want to introduce Henry?
All right, Henry. Henry is on the first Thursday of each month. Henry talks to us about what's going on in the film business when it comes to Westerns. He is the film editor of True West Magazine, which we have a copy right here. And he has a big article in there about Walter Hill. I think this is a current issue. Mm-hmm. And Henry, take it away. What's happening?
Okay, yes, and thank you. And it was great to... delighted that Walter Hill has a new Western out, Dead for a Dollar, and highly recommend it. I'm happy to say there is a lot happening on the Western front. Now, how long ago do you think Tombstone came out?
Oh, my gosh.
91, wasn't it?
30. Christmas Day, 30
years. 30 years. I think it's 30 years.
That's exactly right. Unbelievable to me, but it is 30 years. And June 23rd through the 25th, they'll be holding the Tombstone 30th cast reunion. And guess where?
In Tombstone.
Yes, Tombstone. Which, of course, is not where they shot it. They shot it at Mescal, Western town in near Old Tucson. But that is where the actual shooting took place, like the gunfight at the OK Corral. By the way, have you guys ever been to Tombstone?
Yeah, I was there for a film festival for Sundown My short, and we took the day and went to Tombstone. And I was just going to say, if you're a fan of Westerns and you've never been to Tombstone, make the trek. It's cheap, easy, and it's just a great time. Plan on spending a whole day.
Yeah, it's great fun.
I particularly love the Birdcage Saloon, which was closed in 1881, and when the silver mines gave out, and it didn't reopen until 1932. And nothing has been changed. The bullet holes are still in the walls. Yeah. It really feels like time traveling.
You can stick your finger in the bullet holes. It's okay.
That's right. Now, they're going to have several symposiums and autograph sessions at the Oriental Saloon that Wyatt Earp owned. Attendees include Michael Biehn, who played Johnny Ringo, Dana Wheeler Nicholson, who played Maddie Earp, Joanna Pakula, who played Big Nose Kate, and although she has a small nose, Billy Zane, who played Mr. Fabian, Chris Mitchum, who played Charlton Heston's foreman, and our pal Peter Schirraco,
yes,
who of course played Texas Jack Vermilion. And Peter also organized the Buckaroos, who did all the hard riding. And in fact, Peter's giving a talk about the formation of the Buckaroos. Also, Lisa Collins, who played Louisa Earp, Robert Burke, and John Philbin, who played the McClory brothers. And you'll think I'm wrong about this, but I'm not. Wyatt Earp, who played Billy Claiborne. He's actually Wyatt Earp III. He's a distant relative. And you can buy tickets and learn more at tombstone30th.com.
Yeah.
Now, the Cannes Film Festival opened with Killers of the Flower Moon, the first Western directed by Martin Scorsese, although he did produce The High-Low Country from the Max Evans book. And the reaction has been universally stellar. And since I'm talking to people who actually read, I'll add that it's based on David Grant's book about the series of murders of Osage Indians after oil was discovered on their Oklahoma land. Incidentally, former Osage Chief Jim Gray, some of whose ancestors are portrayed in the film after seeing it, wrote, quote, "The dignity and care for the Osage perspective was genuine and honest throughout the process, and the Osage responded with the kind of passion and enthusiasm that met this historic moment," unquote. And happily, although it's an Apple TV Plus production, Paramount is distributing it in theaters starting October 6th. So you don't have to get another streaming service to see it.
Yay!
I don't want any more of those. Now, for Yellowstone, the good news is the second half of season 5 begins in November. The bad news is that it's the last season of Yellowstone. But the other good news is that the Duttons will be returning in some form with Matthew McConaughey. The show's creator, Taylor Sheridan, and its star, Kevin Costner, could not come up with a shooting schedule that would work for both of them. It's funny, when I talked to Costner on the eve of starting season 2, he was not that happy. He said he'd agreed to just one season and felt pressured to go beyond that because of the sense, especially back then, that the show would fold without him. But what he said he really wanted to do was to make a big Western saga called Horizon in 3 or 4 parts, but he couldn't get the financing. Well, now he has got the financing. The first movie is in the can, and he's shooting the second one, and I'm pretty sure Yellowstone gave his career the boost that made it possible. So I think Costner in Yellowstone was a big win for everybody involved. And we're supposed to be getting a season 2 of 1923 sometime.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And not 1883, because, you know, it's like trying to do Romeo and Juliet 2. Everyone that matters is gone. And the new Taylor Sheridan produced, but not written by, series about lawman Bass Reeves has been shot. And it's planned as the first of a lawman franchise. So it looks like we're going to have plenty to watch, and you can read all about this and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
We love getting caught up, Henry. Whenever you're with us, then right afterwards we're running to the TV and we're looking for all the things that you told us about.
Well, you don't have to start running for most of these until October or November, until we get more info.
Oh, really fun. And I know you're going to stay on with us. We're always delighted to have you stay on when you can. And we're going to shift gears a little bit now, and we're going to talk with Bob Brill. You have a little something you want to say?
We have a little intro here.
Yeah, we all know you, Bob, but we know a lot of our listeners may not have met you yet.
Bob Brill. Bob Brill is an award-winning journalist, author, filmmaker, and longtime radio broadcaster. His work as a network radio correspondent for UPI Radio took his career to the next level in the 1980s, and Bob continues to anchor the news on radio in L.A. His work as an author, screenwriter, and film producer continues to grow, and he has recently optioned his passion script, which looks to be made an episode series. Welcome, Bob.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, guys. And I'm now a songwriter, too, because of the podcast, I co-wrote two of the songs. So what can I say?
You are a man of many talents, We, if we have time tonight, we plan to talk about three books, and they're all entirely different from one another.
Right.
Yeah. Let's talk about the first one. Let's see, Fan Letters to a Stripper. A Paddy Wagon Tale, and he's holding up the
book.
He's holding up the book. You might okay. Oh, good. We see it. Yeah, we got it now. Yeah, perfect. This has a really interesting backstory, and then it has a very interesting sort of current story. Bob, why don't you tell us a little bit about Paddy Wagon, how you first kind of saw her, and tell us about the development of the book and what's going on now.
Well, the beginning was really easy because it was my sixth birthday. It was June 26, 1959. And my mom allowed me to, she wanted to get me out of the house basically because my sister was throwing a surprise party for me and with the neighborhood kids. And so she told me my birthday was tomorrow. And so she took me up to Woolworths in Pittsburgh and Mount Oliver, which was our local shopping area when I was growing up in Pittsburgh. And she loved, and I decided I was going to buy some baseball cards. Hadn't had any. My brother had them. My cousins had them. I didn't have any yet. And on the back of the 1959 Topps baseball cards was a cartoon about the player. Well, in Don Rudolph's case, I had a Don Rudolph card in the first pack, turned it over, and it wasn't about him. It was about his wife. It was a picture of Paddy Wagon. It was a cartoon of Paddy Wagon, who was, and it said Don's wife is a professional dancer. She wasn't just a professional dancer. She was one of the highest paid strippers in the country at the time. And she was on the burlesque wheel. She sang. She did some great stuff. She was really well known. And so even at 6 years old, I looked at it. This is really bizarre. Why she had my baseball card? And over the years, I was always intrigued by this. And eventually I wrote an article for a baseball card magazine. And I did some more research and I contacted Don's brothers. I contacted Don and Patty's daughter, their only child, and I wrote an article for Beckett magazine, and it was also online, and it just blossomed from there. And I always even knew as a kid that there was going to be something bigger than this, because they lived right pretty much a mile away from where I grew up in the San Fernando Valley when we moved from Pittsburgh. And so basically, over the years, I've written some articles and collected memorabilia, and I ended up getting much of the estate through a storage locker that went delinquent that somebody else bought that happened to have all their family stuff, and then I bought it.
Oh my gosh!
Him. And I have her costume she wore on stage, and she wore in a film called Too Hot to Handle, which was not the mainstream film; it was a burlesque film, and. All sorts of stuff. And then we negotiated some rights from the family. And so we're moving forward. And then, so we did the book back in 2009, which is what I call a coffee table biography. It's filled with photos and letters that fans wrote to her, good, bad, and ugly. And then I decided, then I wrote a screenplay, and we weren't having much luck selling the screenplay. And I decided, what the heck, we'll make it into a podcast. I hired about 25 actors, some were radio guys and friends of mine. And so, because it's all audio, obviously. And we did two versions of the podcast. One's 12 episodes, and the other is a full length, 2.5 hour, just like a motion picture. So you can, they're both free. So you can both listen to either one. If you're on a long drive, you can listen to the long version. If you want to do episodic, you can listen to those. And we link that to a website. The title of the book was Fan Letters to a Stripper. The title to the podcast and the screenplay was Major League Stripper, because she married a major league player. And so what we did, we got majorleaguestripper.com. If you go there on the homepage, and there's all sorts of things you can buy and things like that too. But if you are on the homepage, there's two boxes. You click on one for the episodic podcast, and you click on the other, it'll take you to the mainstream podcast, which is actually on YouTube. And it has some video, but it's not a dramatic video. It's just some pictures. But you're there for the audio anyway. So, and then about the time I was getting ready to release that, which was earlier this year, I got a call from a producer in New York who had seen, he was looking for something on a film called Too Hot to Handle, not the one that Patty was in. And the one that Patty was in came up. And he said, wow, she's amazing. This is a great story. So he starts researching it and found me. And he called me in the clear blue sky. It was a Tuesday afternoon. And he calls me and we talked. And I had never met anybody more enthusiastic about Paddy Wagon and Don Rudolph than me until then. We talked. We had a couple of conversations. He optioned the screenplay and the book rights. And so basically, we are now working on putting together, and I can't tell you his name because he hasn't been released yet, but we're now working on, because there's so much involved here as far as their story, and it is their story. It's actually two stories into one. And so they want to do an 8-episode, 8-hour streaming, limited series. And so I am writing that now. I'm over halfway written in the episodes. And it's the hardest job I've ever done. But the references are easy because I have hundreds of letters that she and Don wrote back and forth. And they talk about not just them, but they talk about the events of the time, stuff that's going on. And it's brought a whole new world to me because now I'm reading these letters. I had already read the letters from fans, so I have that. And the people that stalked her, just stuff that is just amazing that you couldn't, it's a screenwriter's dream to have all this stuff, you know? And then of course the embellishment of Hollywood and the dramatic, additions and everything. It's been fun. It's hard, but it's fun.
Yeah. You know, go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to ask this question, which may be a little naive on my part, but can you talk to us just a little bit about the option process without necessarily throwing in a lot of details?
Sure. Options are a little different than shopping agreements. A shopping agreement is basically you get some time, you pay whatever, and you make an agreement. They try to go out and find the money, and if they can't, they can't, then you move on. An option, there's several different things about options. They can go many different ways. What we're looking at is a one-year option and with an option for a second year. And basically, it's a chance for the producer. He's secured the rights for that period of time. Nice. He has exclusive rights to go out and try to raise the money. And we're talking a substantial amount of money for this because we're talking stadiums and theaters and a lot of actors and different locations. And it goes mainly through their minor league time and her big league time. And then into the major leagues and then into the late '60s. And it's a 25-year period that this covers. And so there's a lot involved. And then if let's say you do an option for a year and you can get, you know, some guys will option a screenplay for $1, and that's basically it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but this was substantially more than that. And then once the year is up, usually, you know, if they're close or they're still in the process, you extend the option for another year or so. If not, if the option is, we're not going to do this anymore, everybody goes their separate ways and you look for somebody else. So that's basically just a sort of a ABC type of on the options.
Good. I appreciate that.
You know, I was thinking last night, Bob, that our very, very first show of Rendezvous with a Writer, Courtney Joyner, was our guest. And one of the things that Court, and you know him well, he's another one of our original clan. But one of the things that he challenged on that show, writers to think about, what else can it be? So you've written the story, you know, it's a short story, it's a novel, whatever it is, but where else can it live? And as we were discovering with this book, you know, you've done a podcast. You're working it through every kind of channel and angle that you've come up with what you have to work with. And I think that's something that we would want to continue to encourage writers to think about that might be listening is what have you got and what can you do with it?
Now, in today's world, you have a lot of fingers. You know, there's podcasts, there's streaming, there's movies, there's TV, there's all sorts of stuff. And I've had this story for 6 decades.
Yeah.
More than 6 decades, you know. And as time progressed, when the technology got bigger, there's more things I could do with it. Back when I first, let's say in the 80s or so, there wasn't much I could do with it outside of movies. You know, and maybe not even really TV. And in radio, you do maybe an hour documentary, and that's not going to make any money anyway. But, you know, and now today there's so many different avenues. And with the memorabilia that I have and the letters, there's really an extension that I could just mention that the memorabilia world is on fire right now. And if this gets made like we plan to have it made, and this story becomes well-known worldwide, which it could very easily be because, well, I'll tell you in a second on that, there's a whole host of where this memorabilia could go. And like the producer and myself have been talking, it's really the 3 B's from Double B, okay? Bob Brill to, because she was a motorcycle rider and a champion motorcycle rider.
Yes, she was.
Baseball, bikes, and babes. What else do we have?
Baseball, bikes, and babes. Yeah, we like that.
That's the perfect scenario. You can't ask for anything better. And it translates to other countries, too, because, you know, in Japan, baseball is huge. In Europe, motorcycles are huge.
Yes.
And everybody loves pretty women, right? So, and there's a lot of pretty women. And I will just mention scantily clad. I mean, there's going to be some nudity, but it's all. But what I'm writing is done in very good taste, really is. And I mean, the way I write this stuff. First of all, let me put it this way: when I wrote the original screenplay, I wrote a 2.5-hour movie about a baseball player and a burlesque star who works in the sex industry. And it is, burlesque was the sex industry. I mean, different from prostitution in some ways. But I wrote a 2.5-hour movie with no nudity, you know, and really with only, you know, one sex scene. But, you know, that's the kind of story this is. It is a tremendous, tremendous love story. It happens to have baseball and motorcycles. And the episode I'm writing right now, they're in Cuba in 1959, right after he's playing ball there, and in the Cincinnati organization, they had a team in Havana, and it was right after the Cuban Revolution, after, you know, Castro took over, and there were still lots of problems they were trying to figure out, and I found out, and this is going to be part of the scene, Castro's people took all, as many as they could round up of Batista's henchmen who were still there, who never made it out. They held a mock trial at one of the stadiums in Havana, and they executed it right on the field as people watched.
Oh, my God.
That powerful, powerful scene, and it's going to be there.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, Bob, hold that thought. And actually, we're going to take a very quick, not really a break, but we're going to tell you where you can find many of Bob's books. And we're going to be right back with Bob and Henry in just a moment after this word from Out West Shops Bookshop. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shops Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer, Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writers. Special guests, Henry Park and Bob Rill. We were just discussing
the first of three books we're going to try to get through tonight. Bob is just so prolific, and every book has such a great story behind it. Bob, we're going to move right now into the next book, The Tattoo Murder. We'll hold it up here.
See if good. You have a better copy than me.
The Tattoo Murder. This was such a great read. Why don't you go ahead tell us about the backstory, where it takes place, and what inspired it?
Well, The Tattoo Murder is basically about an Italian-American cop who lives in Ventura. He's a former Army Ranger who fought in the Balkans during the 90s when the war was going on there. Was raised in Ventura, California, which is a coastal town between Santa Barbara and Los Angeles. I spent two terms there, so to speak. I lived there for about a year as a child, and then back in the 90s through the early 2000s, I lived and worked out of Ventura. And it's a beautiful little city, very, very tight. And again, it's on the coast. And John Potenza, who is the cop we're talking about, the detective, is a surfer, loves to surf at night, loves to surf anytime. And that's kind of where he gets his downtime. And the story, The Tattoo Murder, involves basically when a body washes up on shore in Ventura, a bloated body with tattoos. It kind of sets the chain in motion. And John Potenza has to solve not only the murder, but hold off a war between two warring bicycle gangs, as well as trying to solve the overall picture of this, which I can't go into much after that. But Potenza he's a good looking guy. He is loves his music. There's a lot of music referred to in the book. And he kind of solves things old school. Has an Italian mom who was a war bride, so to speak, and does a lot of cooking, and he knows his way around a kitchen. But he also knows his way around the ladies, has his mean squeeze. But he's sort of a local James Bond when it comes to women in the story. And I know I see Jim giggling, so I know Jim liked that part of the book. So it's a fun read, but it's pretty detailed. And it's the first. There will be a sequel. It's already planned, and but it's a book that I some of the characters are based on people that are real, that from Ventura, and the names are changed to protect the guilty, so to speak.
Go ahead.
We talked about this the other night, but you know the dedication here. You dedicated the book to John Fogerty. Is there a little backstory on that?
Just the fact that I've always been a Fogerty fan, and Creedence was one of my favorites. But some of the music John Potenza will be driving his convertible down the road at high speed or go through the hills or wherever, and he's got Fogerty playing on his CD. And the other thing is that Fogerty's music plays a really good role in reference to the end of the book.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Yeah, one more question. You know, we have the reference to James Bond. So Bond is famous for martinis, and our character, John Del Potenza, comes up with his own martini, and every bar in town serves it because they want to have it on hand when he drops in.
Yes. Martini is a good drink. But if there's also, over the years, there's been a wide variety of changes in the martini, mainly with flavors. And there's a special limoncello that was made up until about 2 years ago. And I hate to say the family that made it went out of business. They went through a divorce, and it isn't being made anymore. But there are probably still some bottles out there. It was an award-winning limoncello, and these martinis that he likes course, he's Italian and has a lot of heritage there, and like me. And the limoncello is added along with a couple of other little things in the martini, and it's his drink, you know. And it's probably stirred, not shaken, as opposed to shaken, not stirred. But it is his local drink, and every bartender in town knows when he walks in, that's what they're serving.
And what is it called?
You had to ask me that. It's been a while.
I don't know if it had a name.
Oh, I thought it was like the slum. I thought it had a name. Oh, maybe.
I'll let you guys come up with a name, and I'll put it in the next one.
Because this is, of course, a work of fiction, unlike the first book that we talked about, when you had fan letters and things, were you a pantser or an outliner?
A little bit of both. More pantser than outliner. I do outline in general. I also change that outline depending on where I am, depending on the flow of the book. I'd say, you know, like most people, I'm more of a pantser than an outliner, but I pretty much know where I know the beginning, I know the end, I know some of the middle. It's just a matter of connecting the dots. And sometimes the dots will take me off in different direction, and sometimes they don't.
So did our detective, John, surprise you at all? Did he do things you did not expect him to do, or not do things you wanted him to do?
No, I think there's a reference. I know it's been referenced in a couple of reviews, which kind of made me happy. I love movies, as you know, and I'm a big movie fan. That's why I write, you know. And there's a scene, excuse me, in the book where he and FBI colleagues are discussing one of the murders. And a reference to a movie comes up, a line, and the FBI guy recognized that, and John recognized, and they start playing movie lines off each other. And that went really well. And as a scene in a film, that's a great scene. I mean, it's one of those bang, boom, boom, bam, boom, you know, and everybody can pretty much relate to. And it's, I think that was a surprise. But as far as overall, you know, I had, when I originally wrote this book, which was back around 2005 or so, I set out to write a fairly racy novel. And this is racy, but it's not as racy as it originally was. And I made the mistake of letting, or actually good fortune, of letting my sister and my daughter read it. And my daughter got through about 10 pages and said, I can't read this. My dad wrote this, you know, and I can't do that. And I said, okay. And my sister basically had the same reaction. And so I set it on the shelf for about 10 years. And I decided at some point I'm going to rewrite it and tone it down. And that's, I had several people encourage me to do that at that particular time, including a psychiatrist friend of mine. I guess you can't. Your friendly psychiatrist. I'm not going to say my psychiatrist, because that's not it. But so I did. And that's kind of where it went from there.
Henry, do you have any questions for Bob?
Well, I'm a big fan of the city of Ventura myself. I spend all the time there I can. And I was wondering what about Ventura in particular made you want to set the story there?
Well, a couple of things. I was living there at the time, which made it easy for reference. And I knew Ventura very well. And I knew some cops there and had been friends with them. So all that kind of played into it, the familiarity of it all. And if you notice in the book, there's like 10 pages in the middle. I went out and my wife took the pictures. We took pictures of specific areas where these fictional crimes took place that are actual places, which was an idea that I've had for a long time. And then the other thing was every scene in the book is highlighted at the beginning of where, when, how, like a movie screen. And that was another thing that I wanted to do for a long time. And being in Ventura with the familiarity of the places like downtown, or at the boatyards or at the fairgrounds or whatever, made it very easy for me to do that. And that's really why it's set in Ventura. It could have been set in Santa Barbara, but I would have had to spend more time in Santa Barbara. And Santa Barbara's a lot more expensive than Ventura.
That's a great question. Let's see. Let me just see if I have it. Oh, you were talking about the FBI a moment ago. Stereotypically, quite often on different shows that we might watch, the FBI, when they come into a local area, don't always get along very well with the local police. I can think of Blue Blood episodes and others. And how was it to write scenes where the FBI were working along with the local
detectives? It was interesting because I did borrow a couple of things from the past there. And I think if you read the book, you'll figure that out. But the FBI, I've known a lot of agents over the years and I've known a lot of cops over the years. I mean, just in my work as a reporter in radio and news over the years. So I kind of got a sense of someone, and I had a very good friend who taught me when I was a very young boy. He was an FBI agent. We spent some time together, and I got to really understand some of the techniques that the FBI used, and I used that a little bit in the book, and then later on as well. And I'm very well connected with the DEA. I'm on one of their charities here in LA, one of their charity boards for the DEA Survivors Benefit Fund. So I've gotten to know federal agents, even though DEA guys don't get along with FBI guys. And a lot of times FBI guys don't get along with local cops because the cops look at them as somebody coming in with more authority in certain regions who want to take over the case. Yeah. So it was fun to write, and I had to be, you know, kind of careful about how I wrote that because, you know, you write, want to write drama and you want to write conflict, but you also don't want to piss off somebody else. Show up someday. But no, I'm not joking about that. I'm joking about that.
One other quick question on this book. Where did you come up with a zigzag gun?
That was, I did some research on that. The zigzag was, there were several different models over the years. But when I'm thinking about guys that roll their own smokes, of course, you, and I should tell you that the Hell's Angels, the corporate headquarters has been for years, Ventura, California. I mean, going back decades, that's their corporate headquarters. So I borrowed, you know, some of that stuff. And, you know, when guys build their own smokes, it's usually zigzag papers. And so I started kind of wondering if there was a tie-in there. And I did some research, and sure enough, there was a gun called Zigzag. And it was a small gun. And it worked out perfectly that I could build the story around that particular gun, or at least part of the story around that particular gun. So, yeah, that popped up. I mean, when you start doing research, a lot of times you start finding, like with the paddy wagon thing. I mean, I'm doing research. I'm reading her letters. It's like, oh, my gosh, really? You serious? She did that, or they did that, or this guy? Oh, my gosh. You know, and so it makes it kind of challenging in some ways where you can build that in, but at the same time, it's such a fresh thing. It's like, yeah, I can grasp onto that and take the story in a little different direction, or just add that to the main story.
Is there a sequel coming?
Yep. So you get some time. and I can tell you the title. This was the tattoo murder. The sequel will be called The Belt Buckle Murder.
The Belt Buckle Murder
will be based on an actual case that I covered as a reporter in Fresno back in the 80s. And I'm borrowed from that, but it's going to go much deeper. There's going to be some political intrigue, and part of it's going to be the body going to be found outside of Ventura. Everything comes back to Ventura, but it happens. And it is a direct link from the end of the tattoo murder to The Belt Buckle Murder.
The next one. Okay, I'm looking at our time, and we're going to jump right into book number three now. And that is Lancer, Hero of the West. This is part of a series, and this is the most recent one, The Broken Bow Affair. But we have others in the series. I'm just going to I'm just going to hold them up.
Oh, that was a terrible cover. You don't have to hold that one. The red one's a terrible cover. I designed that cover. So the best were usually designed by my my daughter, who's a great graphic artist, but I always lean on her a little bit, except for the last one. She didn't have time.
Once again, this is the current.
That's the current
this
one.
The current yeah. one.
And I think that is probably one of the best. I really do. That's number 6 in the series. There will be 10. I have dedicated myself to get 10, and I know what number 10 is. I know what the number 7 is. 8 and 9 are still in that's down the road a little bit. But Lancer is a good guy gunslinger who works out of Tombstone. He is a wealthy guy who has separated himself from his former career as a military guy. And military intelligence. And he is one of those guys who's kind of aloof, but everybody likes him. He's kind of mysterious as far as his past, but he keeps running across people that know him from his past. And he goes out of Tombstone. He's good friends with the Earps and Holiday and obviously bad friends with Johnny Ringo and some of the other guys. So basically, each story opens with him having conversations with the Earps about what's going on. And then he goes elsewhere to solve crimes and murders and whatever there is. And in this particular, well, in every book there, he along the way in his travels to getting to where he's going, he runs into at least one legendary character. And I kind of obviously make that up. Because, you know, I mean, most of these legendary characters in the West, they're legendary because of the stories they told, about themselves, not because of what somebody else told about them. And he runs into, I know Bobby was telling me, she was telling me about the one person he runs into in this particular book. And I was just thrilled that she caught on to that. Because that's the fun part, is coming up with these legendary characters and how I can weave them in. And they may reappear in another book down the road.
And that's fun for a reader. You know, yeah. I think that's fun for the reader. And of course, he's known for carrying something very tasty in his saddlebags.
There we go. There we go.
And Bob usually has it. Awesome.
Yes, and every time I do the Cowboy Festival, I usually bring a little extra box for you.
Bring it here.
that's Turkish Delight. A lot of people don't know what Turkish Delight is, but it is a very sweet, very kind of semi-gooey taste treat that you pick up with your fingers. It was developed for the Sultans in the Middle East centuries ago, and it still exists today. Most of the time you can buy it like at a British store, or there are some stores in the Jewish section of Los Angeles that also carry it. Any kind of ethnic store is usually a place you can buy it. And it comes in a box like this, but that thick, and there's usually 15 or 20 pieces in the box. You just pick them up and eat them. There's lemon and rose flavored and pistachio and a few others. And they're just dusted with powdered sugar. And you can eat 3 or 4 of these without knowing it.
Yeah, easily. Easily.
Lancer carries, and you don't have to refrigerate it. That's the great thing, which makes it perfect for Lancer, who carries it in his saddlebags. And he uses it as a door opener, usually with the ladies. You may remember the movie Spy Game with Brad Pitt and Robert Redford. And one of the things that Robert Redford told Brad Pitt when they were teaching him how to be a spy, he said, "You always carry a pack of cigarettes." Well, in my books, nobody's going to have cigarettes as far as the good guys go. He said, "You always carry a pack of cigarettes because it's an icebreaker." Uh-huh. And for Lancer, the icebreaker is Turkish Delight.
Yeah.
There you go.
And Lancer is another one of these, you know, all the men would like to be him and all the women would like to be with him. And his reputation precedes him. Of course, you know, we're up to book 6, so he's known. I mean,
yes.
And for book 6, he's contacted by a cattlemen's association in Nebraska.
Yes.
And he's already got some work set up for him in California when he gets back from solving the challenge in Nebraska. So right. I know what's also fun about him is when you look at his holster, if you didn't know who you were talking to, you will know now who you're talking to. So what's special about his holster? Yeah.
Cross lances. he has cross lances. Paladin had a chest piece because a paladin is a chest piece. And Lancer has a crossed set of lances.
Yeah.
And so that's and I actually borrowed that. One of my favorite TV shows when I was a kid was Lives of the Bengal Lancers, 77 Bengal Lancers. And I was looking for a name. I wanted something that, like John Potenza, the word Potenza in Italian means force or forceful or power. And so I wanted a name for Lancer that kind of spoke to something along that line. And so I did the lances. And I looked at all sorts of royal and stuff like that. Nothing really fit. And so that's kind of, and Patty Wagon, I don't have to worry about. So,
right. Well, yes. And he always corrects people. They want to say Mr. Lancer. And he always says, it's just Lancer, you know, it's just Lancer, just Madonna, or it's just, you know, it's like he Michael. Just goes by the first name, you know. Well, I'm looking at a clock I hate to look at. Bob, very quickly, tell us where listeners can find you and follow you. Where do they go?
Well, there are several places. If you are just looking for books, of course, there's Amazon. I have an author page on Amazon, obviously. And also, you can go to bobbrillbooks.com. All my books are there, and there's some background, and you can order books there. And if you want a signed copy, then obviously that I'll do that as well. And that I can't do that off Amazon, but I can do it off my own website. Then also bobbrill.com has links to pretty much everything I do, whether it's the podcast, and I do several different podcasts, Paddy Wagon stuff, the books, whatever it is, and as well as voiceover work and things like that. And the history of some of the things that I do. And you can, if you Google me or Bing or whichever, if you Google Bob Brill or Bob Brill Reporter, it comes up two different things. I'm usually about 17 of the first 20 that come up. I'm not Bob Brill, the set designer. I'm not Bob Brill, the IP attorney in Chicago. And believe me, I am definitely not Bob Brill, the bodybuilder. So,
stay with us, Bob. Henry, how can people follow what you've got going on?
Oh, well, they can, of course, go to www.henryswesternroundup.com. They can find my columns in every issue of True West magazine. And I also am writing blogs twice a month for the INSP channel. So if you go to the INSP blog, you can find my stuff there.
Well, this has been so fun to have you both with us. And Jim always closes with a quote. So don't go away. Jim's got a couple quotes here. What you got?
Oh, absolutely. Well, now speaking of Potenza, we're from his mom, Angela. And she says, I quote, there are two kinds of people in this world, Italians and those who want to be Italians. And going on with the first book, we have Mae West from the days of burlesque, who said, when caught between two evils, I generally pick the one I haven't tried before.
Next week, our guest is Dan Batson, and we'll be talking about his memoir, Mourning. We've been talking with Bob Brill, Tattoo Murder, and Lancer, along with Fan Letters to a Stripper, The Paddy Wagon Tale, and Henry Park one more time with True West Magazine. And we thank you so much for being with us. And we will see you again next week, this same time, same place, right here on LA Talk Radio. And
remember, every day, a great day
out west. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.